supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Federal prosecutors say Philadelphia Congressman Bob Brady agreed to pay $90,000 from his campaign funds to retire that of an election opponent to get him out of the race. That information was released in a guilty plea by the opponent's campaign manager this afternoon. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies joins me now to sort this all out. And Dave, is Brady being charged with a crime?
No, Dave, let's be clear about that. What we have today is an agreement to plead guilty by the campaign manager of Brady's former opponent. She's pleading guilty to giving false information on campaign finance reports. It's the story that leads to that allegation that involves Brady. 4 years ago, in 2012, a man named Jimmy Moore challenged Brady in the Democratic primary for Brady's congressional seat that he's held for so long. Months before the primary election, Jimmy Moore dropped out. What the feds now say in court filings is that Moore withdrew pursuant to an agreement with Brady, who promised to pay $90,000 from his own campaign funds to retire Moore's debt. The filing says those payments were made through two unnamed political consultants close to Brady. They took the money, paid a company set up by Moore's campaign manager to retire those debts. The campaign manager, Carolyn Cavanis, has admitted to concealing those transactions from the Federal Election Commission. So in short, what the feds say is that Brady agreed to pay $90,000 out of his own campaign funds, not his pocket, to get an opponent out of a race.
Why did Moore say he dropped out at the time?
Just for party unity. It didn't work for him.
And so what do Brady's and the others involved have to say about it?
Not much. I've called Brady, his opponent, the former campaign manager, two political consultants close to Brady that might have been involved. None of them have anything really of substance to say.
Okay, so we have this one guilty plea. Does it appear the feds might charge others as this develops?
Great question, and it is possible, but the feds aren't talking, and there's just no way to know for now.
Dave, would it be illegal if Brady did strike a deal to pay $90,000 to get someone out of the race?
Yeah, that's the critical question, isn't it? I spoke to two former prosecutors and three election lawyers within the past hour, Dave, and didn't get a clear answer. You know, Brady's been chairman of the Democratic Party for 30 years, and he's been making political deals for most of them. And you hear that things like this happen all the time. Somebody wants to run against an incumbent. There's a meeting. He's persuaded to drop out. Then guess what? He gets a job at the parking authority or the register wills office in City Hall. Now, this would be a little different. It's using money from a federally registered campaign committee to clear an opponent out of your way. And one of the three election lawyers I spoke to said, yes, that would be regarded as a crime. But we'll have to wait and see what develops.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. A recent survey found one in six American adults lacks basic literacy skills, and that means there are some 36 million people who can do little more than fill out forms and comprehend basic sentences. It's a huge workforce problem, but can an app help to solve it? A new experiment taking place in Philadelphia and two other cities aims to find out. Details from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
The developers of the Amrita learning app for adult literacy say their tool has shown serious promise. It's touched 300,000 learners across 21 states in India.
One of the biggest challenges we have is the literacy rate that the people in rural India have.
That's Shriv Subramani Krishnamurti of Amrita University. He helped develop the app, which uses competitive mobile games to teach literacy skills. He's bringing it from rural India to urban America as part of a global competition. The goal, says Shlomi Katan, is to find the mobile app that can take adults reading at a third grade level or lower
and get them to above basic literacy in 1 year using nothing more than that mobile app as the primary educational intervention.
Katan works for XPRIZE. You might recognize that name. It's a nonprofit known for holding ambitious public competitions where entrants try to do things like invent the best private spacecraft or the most fuel-efficient car. Katan says XPRIZE wanted to explore adult education because it's an area with big need and few dollars.
So when you look at adult education services over the last 20 years or so, investment in that most basic level, that third grade or below, has decreased by 25% in real dollars.
Now, I'm sure you're wondering, where does Philly come in here? Along with Dallas and L.A., Philly is one of three cities where eight semifinalists will test their apps with real adult learners. The team whose tool creates the biggest gains will win $3 million, to be announced sometime in 2019. Avi Wolf-Manarant, WHYY News.
Over the last 5 years, Philadelphia's housing market has exploded, with median prices going up more than 30% across the city. And now, neighborhoods long overwhelmed by drugs and crime are suddenly being flooded with new construction and luxury townhomes. Can Philly's boom last, or is this a housing bubble about to burst? Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
The band's playing and the champagne's flowing as curious neighbors and would-be buyers start arriving at this realtor's open house. Soon, a burlesque troupe dressed up like flappers starts dancing the Charleston while the guests check out the reclaimed wood floors and slate-top vanities. Swanky open houses like this one are unusual, but not unheard of, in Philadelphia's wealthier neighborhoods, where asking prices this high, $680,000 for a two-bedroom townhouse, are par for the course. But not here. This house is in Kensington, a neighborhood better known for discarded heroin needles than arabesque bathroom tiles. The realtor throwing this jazz theme party, Stephanie Summers, says buyer attitudes are changing. Young professionals and empty nesters aren't afraid of a neighborhood with a bad rep if the price is right.
So I think that there's a level of familiarity that doesn't scare off these buyers from purchasing an exquisite piece of property there, you know, on the border of Kensington and East Kensington. You know, it's Kensington. I mean, they're buying in Kensington.
The luxury row home and three more just like it sold in just a few weeks. Right now, the average home in Philly sells in under 2 months. That's a turnaround time Philly hasn't seen since before the housing bubble broke in 2007. That intense demand and a lagging supply are causing housing prices here to simply explode, says Drexel University economist Kevin Gillen.
Right now, Philadelphia is outperforming not only most other metro areas and other cities, but even its own suburbs.
After years of anemic economic growth, the city is recovering from the Great Recession. Lots of longtime renters are ready to buy for the first time. And as they purchase starter homes, the sellers are cashing in their equity and upgrading. For some, this means a colonial in the burbs, white picket fence and all. But increasingly, people are opting for huge modern row homes stuffed with expensive amenities right here in the city. And in order to afford a roof deck and marble countertops, these buyers have to give up a little on location, so they're moving to edgier or up-and-coming neighborhoods. Places like Francisville.
Hi.
Hey, what's up?
How are you?
Jennifer
Good.
Tran
How
lives here in a large, lovingly restored row home with her boyfriend, Eric Griffin. When the couple decided it was time to move out of a cramped condo in Bella Vista, they knew they wanted more space, a big kitchen, and a yard for their dog, Ollie. They could have moved to the suburbs, and a decade or two ago, they would have. But Griffin says they're committed to staying in Philly.
You know, we tried to build in all the things we'd need to stay here. You know, not have to leave the city just to get a yard or just to get some outdoor space or whatever it is. We tried to have everything here that could keep us here in the city long term.
When the couple bought 4 years ago for $500,000, they had the most expensive house on the block. But since then, the street's vacant lots have turned into luxury homes that sell for even more. According to Gillen at Drexel, the same thing is happening in all of the neighborhoods around Center City.
The level of house prices in Philadelphia is at an all-time high. It's about 12 or 14% higher than its previous peak back in 2007 at the peak of the boom.
The high prices have fueled a construction boom. Thousands of new condos, row homes, and apartments are springing up across the city like flowers after a spring rain. As housing supply catches up to demand, realtors like Summers worry we're in a demand-driven bubble.
My crystal ball would say sell within the next year and a half to 2 years because I just don't see this lasting. I'm really concerned about the new construction. There's a lot of that going on. I'm wondering when the demand for that is going to be not so interesting.
Housing prices can keep going up only if two things occur. One, the city has to continue to grow in population. That seems to be happening still, although it did slow down last year. Two, Philly needs more jobs. The city's unemployment and poverty levels remain stubbornly high. If Philly stops growing, then Gillen and other economists say we're probably in a housing bubble that may pop in the near future. But if the population continues to grow as people relocate from the suburbs and other cities, and we don't see broad job growth, then Gillen says Philly will have a different kind of problem on its hands.
You move to a permanent plateau of unaffordability like New York or San Francisco has, where homeownership is just out of reach for most people, and the cost of housing, whether it be owning or renting, consumes a much higher share of your income than it would in less pricey cities. We don't want either one of those situations.
One of Philly's competitive advantages is its relative affordability. As hot as the market is right now, real estate is still cheap, which means rents are relatively affordable, which keeps the cost of just about everything else pretty low. So, is this a bubble, or is it a slow path to painfully higher rents? Or can home values really keep growing in a truly sustainable way? It's hard to know. But here's the thing. 10 or 20 years ago, you could have said the same thing about housing prices in DC, Portland, or Seattle. Afraid of scaring away growth after decades of decline, the political leaders in those cities didn't do enough to maintain affordable housing. And today, they're extremely expensive places to live. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Thursday is a feast day for St. Pantaleon, a third century physician who lived in what is now Turkey and is the patron saint of doctors and winning lottery numbers. While fairly obscure in the United States, Pantaleon is popular in Italy, where his feast day is widely celebrated. A Catholic church in a small village in southern Italy has been missing its statue of the saint for more than 80 years. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that it's been hiding out on the third floor of a row home in South Philadelphia.
Maria Concetta Carrido arrived in Philadelphia from Italy in the 1920s. She was quintessential South Philly.
At 10th and Wharton, right around the corner from Pat Steaks and Gino's.
That is Carrido's great-grandson, Ed Nader.
My grandmother lived at 1305 South 10th Street. We lived at 1307 South 10th Street. My aunt lived at 1330 South 10th Street. So we spent a lot of time in my great-grandmother's house.
In that house, on the third floor, Nader remembers a thing of horror. A six-foot statue of a pale figure tied to a tree in the throes of death. His great-grandmother had turned a closet into a shrine to St. Pantaleon. It was lit from beneath by candles, which gave the whole thing a menacing glow.
So we as children, every time we had to go to the third floor, had to go to my grandmother's bathroom, we'd run past that little room because we were so frightened of this statue. Four generations, so it scared my mother, me, my aunt, her children, my children.
When Nader's great-grandmother passed away, the family held on to the statue. Even as creepy as it looked, after 80 years, it had become a family heirloom. So when Nader moved to Exton, Pennsylvania, the statue went with him.
Yeah, he's not something you want to look at every day.
That is Ed Nader's wife, Kathleen. She keeps it in the den under a sheet.
If he was more of a majestic pose, you know, maybe I would keep him in the living room. But he is a little scary and he's a little frightening. He can scare you.
But the statue of St. Pantaleon was not a family heirloom. It was a sculpture commissioned by a church in the small village of Montoro, in the Calabria region of southern Italy. It was fabricated in 1936 by an artist in Massachusetts. We know that because it's signed. And it was taken to Boston to be paraded through the streets during the saint's feast day. A committee of parishioners from Montoro were traveling with the statue at the time, and they stopped in South Philadelphia to visit Maria Concetta on the way back to Italy.
On the way home, for whatever reason, they chose not to take the statue with them, and I don't know why, but they left it there, and they said, Concetta, we'll come back and we'll get it. Well, they were never heard from again. They didn't come back and get it.
And there it stayed, on the third floor of the row home, giving nightmares to four generations of children. Nobody knew that this statue was meant for an Italian church. That realization happened completely by chance. Last year, the Naders were traveling with family through Italy on vacation. They wanted to see the birthplace of Ed's great-grandmother. Montoro is a tiny village that gets very few tourists, so the mayor thought he should meet these six Americans passing through. They got to talking through an interpreter, and the subject of St. Pantaleon came up. Suddenly, the Italians got very excited.
We had no idea what they were talking about, and the interpreter, he was trying to interpret for us in English, and he's saying wait, and he's telling us to wait. So we really couldn't get a word in edgewise, whether it was Italian or English.
Long story short, the Naders decided the Italians should have their statue back. Ed and Kathleen footed the bill for shipping, which came to a few thousand dollars, so St. Pantaleon could be back in Montaro in time for his feast day this week.
We're just thrilled. I feel like now I know why we have it, why Eddie's parents and grandparents have kept this. There was a reason why it came to us, and it's our obligation now to get it back to them.
It's God's will.
It is God's will.
There you go again.
It is God's will, yeah. I never questioned it, and you know, it was just like, yes, that's what we do. We send it back.
Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
After consecutive 7-9 seasons, the Eagles look to tilt the ledger to the positive side and perhaps even earn a playoff berth this time around. Let's assess their chances with Philadelphia Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes. Marcus, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Well, Marcus, they say hope springs eternal. In this case, hope summers eternal. I don't know. Every year we have the greatest hopes for the Eagles. Their makeup is substantially different this year toward the better.
Well, it looks that way on paper, and that probably is true. And the name everybody wants to sort of get behind is Alshon Jeffrey, the $17 million one-year wide receiver, who has been a franchise wide receiver and was signed ostensibly to help Carson Wentz, the most important person in Philadelphia who plays sports, writes sports, or talks about sports, help him progress from his rookie season through his sophomore season.
Is this big as once upon a time bringing in Terrell Owens to be the ultimate answer, or we're not at that stage yet?
Well, you know, I mean, Terrell Owens was a different animal at this point. He was at the peak of his career. It was a very convoluted soap opera to get him here, you know, from San Francisco via Baltimore.
Of course, but that soap opera continued while he was here.
Exactly. And continues afterwards. And continues today. But Alshon, I think, is more a one-off gamble to a degree, because he's never been what Terrell Owens was, and he isn't what Terrell Owens was when he got here.
Of course, we're burying the lead. It is presumably all about now sophomore Carson Wentz.
Absolutely. He really needs to progress for a lot of different reasons. His head coach, Doug Peterson, his offensive coordinator, Frank Reich, his quarterback's coach, Don DeFilippo, all of their promotions, all of their careers, the next step ride on what he does, you know, this year and beyond. And it's interesting, he's already on a pitch count, quote unquote, after experiencing soreness in his elbow at the end of last season. They're going to be, I think, a little more careful with him this year going through training camp. And I'd be surprised if you see Carson Wentz get the normal workload. And I don't know that that's a bad idea, especially in a Doug Peterson offense where you can throw the ball until your arm falls off.
And so with that, will Peterson's success this season be determined in largest measure on Wentz's development, even more than wins and losses at the end of the season?
Absolutely. If Carson Wentz is seen to take a step backward or sort of stay in place and the Eagles win 7 or 8 games, that's a negative for Doug Peterson. And so much of what they did in the offseason via free agency, you know, getting depth in the offensive line, inserting Isaac Seumalo, a third-round pick at left guard, which is, you know, it's the worst conversation to have in a talk show, offensive line, but it's the most important position on the field for the Eagles, more so than wide receiver, because Carson Wentz was harried and hurried, and that affected his development, especially midway through last season when Jason Peters and Jason Kelsey, the left tackle and center, weren't playing well and Lane Johnson was suspended.
The season starts at Washington. 3 of the first 4 games are on the road. The one home game is against the Giants. They were an 11-5 last season. Is it possible that the Eagles are slow to gain traction? And if they start the season 1-3 or 0-4, is it a very tall task to even get to .500?
Football's different. That's the thing I've learned in the last 20 years in Philadelphia and covering the NFL. You can go 0-5 and wind up 10-6 and it not be that big a deal, because Tuesday is a totally clean slate. Things change drastically week to week via injury. Things change drastically via week to week via venue. Things change drastically week to week with your opponent. So it's not like a losing streak in baseball, which we've become very familiar with lately in Philadelphia. And it's not even like a losing streak in hockey where momentum is such a big deal, especially if you have one of those extended road trips, or basketball where, you know, we are the all-time experts in losing in any sort of condensed era. It's just a totally different animal, and things can change very, very quickly and change permanently. You know, for example, the Eagles were very hot until they lost Lane Johnson last year. Then they weren't so hot. One player can make a huge difference if that player is good enough in football, and there's only 16 games.
Marcus, thanks once again for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.